Nope. Can we turn it up? How about now? Okay. So can I ask the people at the back, please let me know if I'm writing too small? And also everybody, please interrupt me if you have any questions. And we'll try to clarify them. So everything, almost everything I'll say is in the notes that I that were distributed. So you hopefully don't have to write too much. I think there weren't enough, so I'll ask the secretaries to have some more for next time. Okay, so I'm going to, you've heard today a lot about black holes. And I'm also going to be telling you about black holes. But these are a different type of black holes. So all the black holes you've heard about are black holes that satisfy two conditions. First of all, they have a spherical horizon. And second, they satisfy uniqueness, meaning that they are completely characterized by, there's a unique solution for a fixed set of conserved charges. So this has been an implicit assumption until recently, I guess until 2001, and in the supersymmetric sector until much more recently than that. And this is not a general true statement. So that's one of the special features of black rings that I'll emphasize. So let me start by clarifying the terminology. So what is a black ring? This is, it's an asymptotically flat, stationary black hole solution in five dimensions that has a horizon whose topology is not spherical, it's instead S1 cross S2. That's what a black ring is. Of course, in string theory, we don't live in five dimensions, but in 10 or 11. And it turns out that when you draw the additional directions that I was suppressing in the picture to go to 10 or 11 dimensions, what you get is what's called a supertube. And supertubes are the microscopic constituents of black rings. And supertubes are what we'll use to actually count microscopically the entropy of black rings, which is one of the goals for these two lectures. Let me emphasize that this type of black hole is, you shouldn't confuse that with something that Samir mentioned this morning. Namely, if you take a black hole, say in four dimensions, that has an S2 horizon, you can always lift that. So this is D equals 4. Of course, you can always lift it to a solution in five dimensions by adding an extra compact direction. And that will have a horizon, S1 crosses, S2 crosses 1. But this is not a black ring, because asymptotically, the space-time is not asymptotically flat. Asymptotically, the space-time will be R3 crosses 1. The space-time will be R1,3. Process one. So this is kind of a trivial way of obtaining black holes with S1 crosses 2 horizons. But of course, these are not asymptotically flat. These black rings over here, if you wish, are embedded. The S1 is not wrapped on a topologically non-trivial cycle. So these objects here are stabilized because of the fact that they carry an angular momentum that prevents them from collapsing. OK? No, so supertubes are objects that, when you reduce them to their minimal description, they are asymptotically flat. Well, there are different supertubes in different dimensions. But of course, when you add these extra directions, you get something that's not asymptotically flat. But the point is that I can reduce, I can suppress enough directions and still be left with something that's wrapped on a trivial contractible cycle, but that's asymptotically flat. OK. So the plan, therefore, is to start by telling you I'm going to give some extra motivation as to why these objects are interesting. Then
we'll discuss in some detail
the microscopic constituents, which are super tubes.
After that, I'll describe the supersymmetric black ring solutions.
Then we'll see how we use the supertube microscopic description to count the entropy, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black rings.
So this is microscopic entropy.
And then if we have time tomorrow,
I'll discuss the connection to 4D black holes.
It turns out there's a very nice connection between black rings in 5 dimensions and black holes in 4 dimensions. And also, I'm not sure in what order we'll do these last 2 points, if we have time, but I'll also say something about the ADS CFT description of black rings. Okay. So let's start by asking, why should we be interested in black rings? And to get to that, let me take over from where more or less Samir left it. So the reason goes back, of course, to Bekenstein and Hawking, who told us that if you have a black hole with a finite area horizon, then you should associate to that object an entropy that's given by the area divided by 4 times Newton's constant. And that raises the question of what are the quantum microstates of this system, such that if you take the log of their number, you get this entropy. This is something that any theory of quantum gravity should explain. And in that sense, black holes provide experimental data for any theory of quantum gravity, in particular string theory. So every time somebody gives you a black hole, it's a test of the theory whether or not you can explain that entropy microscopically. So I hope there are no experimentalists in the audience. But that's the way we look at it. So then black holes provide experimental data. And it's regarded as one of the greatest successes of string theory to have provided an exact microscopic counting of the entropy of certain black holes, in particular supersymmetric black holes. So this was done by Strominger and Pfaffer in 96. Bekenstein and Hawking suggested this relation in 73 and 74. So you see that it took more than 20 years to achieve that. So it's a great success. But it turns out that there are very important implicit assumptions in this microscopic counting, which are not true in general. In particular, this counting assumes uniqueness. And I'll say a little bit more about this in a few minutes. OK, so this is the reason we should be interested in black holes in general. Why should we be interested in black holes in 5 dimensions? Well, first of all, string theory is a theory in more than 4 dimensions, and 5 is the first one after 4. But more precisely, it has to do with the fact that we want to look at supersymmetric black holes to start with, because that's a technical requirement that allows us to have enough control to do the comparison between the microscopic and the macroscopic descriptions. So we want to have supersymmetric black holes. And we also want to look at as many black holes as possible. So in particular, we would like to allow for supersymmetric rotating black holes. Okay, so we would like to have, in particular, rotating black holes. It turns out that because of the uniqueness theorems in 4 dimensions, you can prove there are no rotating supersymmetric finite area with regular horizons black holes in 4 dimensions. So these two requirements force you to go at least to 5 dimensions. In 5 dimensions, there are supersymmetric and rotating black holes. Moreover, it turns out that V equals 5 is much more interesting than V equals 4 for the following reason. As I said, in four dimensions, the uniqueness theorems tell you that any equilibrium black hole, first of all, has a horizon whose topology is a sphere, S2. No other horizon topologies are allowed, for example, S1 versus 1. And moreover, so this goes under the name of topological censorship. Moreover, they also tell you that a black hole is completely characterized by its conserved charges, namely its mass, cage charges, and angular momentum. So if somebody gives you that set of charges, there's a unique solution, and only one, for those charges. In five dimensions, this is not true. So you can, of course, have black holes with S3 horizons, but you can also have black holes, as I black rings, with S1 versus S2 horizons. And in particular, they can be supersymmetric. And moreover, these ones are not completely characterized by their conserved charges. You need additional parameters to specify the solution. So you need the mass, charge, angular momentum, and then some extra parameters, QI, which are not conserved charges. So uniqueness does not hold in five dimensions. The first people to realize this were Roberto Imparana and Harvey Real, who found a black ring solution of pure Einstein gravity in five dimensions. So it's a vacuum solution. And they noticed that for a certain range of parameters, in particular of the angular momentum versus the mass, there is at least two different black ring solutions for that set of conserved charges. So that already establishes that uniqueness fails. So that entails a finite violation of uniqueness, because there's only a finite number, in particular two or three different solutions for a given set of conserved charges. OK, and why then should we be interested in particular in five dimensions, or in black rings in five dimensions? Specifically in supersymmetric ones. There are lots of reasons for that. First of all, as I said, as a general rule, we want supersymmetric solutions because those are the ones we have enough control over to attempt a comparison. But more precisely, the existence of supersymmetric black rings in five dimensions establishes something that's very hard to establish by any other means, which is that black rings can be stable objects, okay, because they are supersymmetric. So this establishes stability, at least of some particular set of black rings. One reason why you might worry that black rings are not stable, and in fact, the non-supersymmetric ones are believed to be highly unstable, is because you probably know that a black string in five dimensions suffers an instability called Gregory-Laflamme instability. And given that a black ring locally is just a piece of string, and especially if it's a big one, you might worry that it's going to suffer from the same instability. So the fact that you can find supersymmetric solutions means that at least some black rings can be stable. They also establish that non-uniqueness holds in the supersymmetric sector. This is important because you might have wondered, well, perhaps if we impose the additional requirement of supersymmetry, then there will be only one black ring for a given set of charges, because we are imposing additional constraints. That's not true. And in fact, we will see that supersymmetric black rings violate uniqueness by an infinite amount. So there's an infinite number of different black rings for a given set of conserved charges. This is all very interesting, even from a pure GR point of view. But the real interest, I think, about these objects is that they have
very important implications for the microscopic counting of the entropy in string theory.
Let me spend a minute just elaborating on that. The reason is the following. The way every single microscopic counting of the entropy was performed, except for black rings, was the following. Somebody gives you a black hole solution with a given set of charges, conserved charges, namely mass, charge, angular momentum, etc. Then the way you count the entropy in string theory, as far as I'm aware, in all cases, is by somehow, we'll be more precise about this later, finding a dual CFT, dual two-dimensional CFT, that's supposed to describe the system in a different, well, supposed to be a dual description. And then you count states in this CFT, which are characterized by the fact that they carry exactly the same quantum numbers as the black hole solution. So basically, you match the symmetries on either side. Okay, so here you count the number of states with the same M, Q, and J. Now, clearly, if uniqueness doesn't hold, then this is not enough, because how do you know what black hole the state you are counting correspond to? If there is more than one black hole for a given set of charges, then you have to decide how are you going to further discriminate or characterize the microstates. And one of the things we'll see is that not only counting microstates with the same conserved charges is not enough, but in fact it's wrong in a specific sense that I'll discuss. And what I mean by this is that we'll reproduce the entropy of black rings by counting microstates that carry different quantum numbers. And I'll give you an argument, or more than one, as to why is the correct thing. This is the correct thing to do. Okay. Yes. No, just a stable. No, and the reason is, as I'll probably mention later, the reason is that it turns out that as far as we know, a supersymmetric or for the supersymmetric black rings that we know of, they can never carry exactly the same quantum numbers as the spherical black hole. So if you tell me what the quantum numbers are, I can already immediately tell you if it's a black ring or a black hole. Otherwise, there could be, you would have to ask which one is entropically preferred, for example. That's a very, very good point. Okay, so not only black rings, supersymmetric black rings, raise all these questions, but they also provide the ideal arena to address them. The reason is, first of all, that we have supersymmetry, and secondly, that we understand what the microscopic constituents are and the mechanism for why those microstates are stable, or why the corresponding black ring is stable. Finally, or almost finally, they have interesting connections uncovered recently to 4D black holes, which is always a good thing. And finally, I think the existence of these solutions exposes the fact that we know very little about black holes or the gravitational physics associated to black holes in higher than 4 dimensions, which is an interesting situation for a theory of quantum gravity. Okay, any questions so far? Good. So let's move to the first topic. So what is a supertube? You can think of it as the simplest example of something called brain expansion. Brain expansion is the phenomenon by which, by some dynamical process, you start with a system that contains some set of D-brains or strings or whatever, and that system blows up or expands into something that contains a high-dimensional set of D-brains or brains in general. So specifically, let's consider a set of fundamental strings, what Samir was calling NS1s, in 2A string theory, and D0 brains. This system preserves one quarter of the supersymmetries of the 2A vacuum. And that's very easy to see because the supersymmetries preserved by the fundamental strings and the D0 brains have some overlap. So they preserve 8 supercharges. And then the statement is that if you add angular momentum to this system, it will expand into a bound state that will contain a tubular D2 brain and, of course, the original fundamental strings and D0 brains. And moreover, the statement is that in this process, supersymmetry will be preserved. So this final expanded state, after you have added the angular momentum, preserves the same supercharges as the original one. OK, so the first question we would like to ask is, how are the original charges, which of course must be conserved in the expansion, realized in the final state? So for that, let me remind you that the way a D2 brain can carry fundamental string charge is by having an electric field. Remember, on the Wall volume of a D2 brain, there is a U1 gauge field. One of the degrees of freedom is a U1 gauge field. So the statement is that if you turn on an electric field along the axis of the D2 brain, that corresponds to dissolved fundamental string charge. I will justify that in a second. And if you turn on a magnetic field, which you can think of as threading the surface, being orthogonal to the surface, that corresponds to dissolved D0 brain charge. The way you see that is by looking at the D2 action, which takes this form. So this is the induced metric, G mu nu, on the D2 brain. This is the field strength of the U1 gauge field on the Wall volume, whose electric and magnetic components we are turning on. And this is the pullback to the Wall volume of the Neves-Schwarz-Neves-Schwarz-2 form, the spacetime Neves-Schwarz-Neves-Schwarz-2 form. So the first thing you see is that if you turn on an electric component, F0i, this is a heuristic argument. It can be made much more precise, but let me keep it like that. If you turn on an F0i, because the only combination that appears in the action is the sum of these two terms, that's equivalent to saying that you're turning on B0i. So an electric field on the D2 brain is something that couples minimally, or is equivalent to, turning on electric components of the NSNS2 form. And remember, the object that sources the electric components of a gauge potential, in this case, the NSNS2 form, is the fundamental string. And similarly, if you look at this part of the action, you see that if you turn on a magnetic component of F, say F12, that will couple to the electric component of the pullback of the Ramon-Ramon-1 form, C10. Say, well, T for time. So turning on a magnetic field sources the electric component of the Ramon-Ramon-1 form, which is the one that's sourced by D0 brains. So the upshot is that turning on these electric and magnetic fields on the Wall volume corresponds, actually, is the way the original charge appears in the final state. OK? Now, of course, immediately, as soon as you have electric and magnetic fields, you know that their cross product will generate a linear momentum density, which in this case, if you take the cross product, you'll see that it is tangent to the cross section of the tube. And this is the way the final state, in which there is a D2 brain, is prevented from collapsing. As soon as you take a D2 brain and you dissolve in it fundamental string charge and D0 brain charge, that generates a linear momentum density, such that when you integrate it around the cross section, will not give a net momentum, linear momentum, because it's a closed curve, but it will generate an angular momentum, J, which is precisely what prevents the system from collapsing. That's the way it achieves stability. Now, how do you prove that not only this system, this is a solution of the equations of motion, but that it's supersymmetric? Well, it's basically indicated at the end of the notes, but all you have to do, the simplest way to do it, is to show that the energy of this D2 brain is equal to the total amount of D0 brain charge dissolved in it plus fundamental string charge dissolved in it. So this means that the energy saturates a BPS bound, and that the only charges that appear on the right-hand side are exactly the same charges you had originally. So the energy of the system is the same as the one you started with. Now, you might have thought that to stabilize such a system with angular momentum, and moreover, to do so supersymmetrically, the cross-section, C, would have to be a perfect circle. This is not true. It turns out that for any cross-section, so any arbitrary curve that can be arbitrarily wiggly in the transverse directions to the axis, this preserves the same supersymmetries. In case this is surprising, let me give you an argument. Yes? On the, sorry? Well, if you really want to use a low energy description, then you want to have smooth contours, et cetera. But formally speaking, no. But of course, at the point when I write down this effective action, I'm assuming that everywhere the extrinsic curvature, there are corrections to that, to this action. Some of them involve derivatives of the field strength, and some of them involve derivatives of the embedding. And I'm assuming that those ones are small. So this effective action is an expansion in which I'm keeping, I'm not including things of the form, for example, second derivatives of the scalar fields that determine the embedding, et cetera. So I'm assuming that those are small. If you have a cusp, then you have a high curvature curve concentrated at the cusp or at the kink. Okay, so just to make contact also with what Samir was saying, if you take this system and you perform a couple of dualities, you can map it to the fundamental string that he discussed with a wave with some momentum moving along the axis. The way you do that is you T-dualize along the axis first. That gives you, and then you S-dualize. So by T-dualizing, the D2, D0 bound state becomes a D1. At an angle. So you get a helical D1 string that carries momentum along the axis because the fundamental strings T dualize to momentum. And of course, because the profile is not a straight line, it carries also angular momentum. And it turns out that the arbitrary, if you take a fundamental string and you put a wave on it that moves only in one direction, either left or right moving at the speed of light, that preserves 1/4 of the supersymmetries for any profile. And that arbitrariness in the wave profile is exactly what maps back to the arbitrary shape of the cross-section. So this system, in a way, is dual to the one that Samir discussed this morning. OK, and one final point that I have to discuss, which you didn't complain about, is how can it be that I start with a system that has no D2 brain charge, and I end up with a system that has a D2 brain in it? The answer is, of course, that there is a D2 brain in the system, but there is no net D2 brain charge. The reason for that, that's very, very important, because that is the origin of the non-uniqueness for the black rings. So let me explain that. The point is that, let me draw it over here. If you have a D2 brain that has one of its directions, or more than one, wrapped on a contractible cycle in spacetime, let's take, for simplicity, a cylinder, then that D2 brain carries no net charge. And the physical reason for that is that if you take a little strip of D2 on this side, and you compare it to the antipodal strip on the other side, those two little strips look like a pair of D2 anti D2, because to take the first one to the second one, you have to reverse the orientation. So what happens is that the net charge, when you integrate it over the whole cross-section, vanishes. However, there is a D2 brain, and there is a local D2 brain density. And in particular, when you write down the supergravity solution for this system, you will find that there is no, and I'll be more precise about this in a second, there is no D2 brain net charge, but there is a D2 brain dipole. So the field that's sourced by the D2 brains is non-zero. And at infinity, it falls off too fast to generate a net charge, but it gives you dipole moments. So I will call those one little Q in general, D2. So capital Qs will be net charges, little Qs will be non-conserved charges, in particular dipoles. So let me be more precise about this. Let me draw over here. Let me take a cross section that's contained in a two-plane. There is no reason for that. As I told you, the cross section can be an arbitrary curve in the transverse space. In this case, this can be a curve in R8, because we have one direction along the axis. But let's take the particular case in which the cross-section is a circle in a given two-plane. And let x, let psi be the angle, the polar angle on the circle, and let x be the distance to the origin. Then what you find is that when you look at the supergravity solution for this system, C3, which is, let me put it like this, which is the Ramon-Ramon freeform that couples to the D2 brain, which is sourced by the D2 brain, at infinity falls off in the following way. So if this is the radius of the circle, it falls off like qd2, the number of D2 brains times r squared divided by x to the 6th, plus subleading terms. Now, if you had a V2 brain with net charge, this at infinity would fall off as 1 over x to the 5th, to the 5th power. So in that case, if you, in this specific case, if you compute the integral over a sphere at infinity, in this case it's a 6th sphere, of the dual of d of C3, this would be the net D2 brain charge, qd2. This turns out to be 0. The reason being, as I said, that this falls off with 1 power of the distance too fast to contribute to the net charge. And the fact that it's actually just 1 power too fast tells you that it's a dipole moment. So there's no monopole charge, but there's dipole moments and higher. Any questions about that so far? So by expanding the potential that couples to the D2 brain at infinity, you can identify the dipoles, but there is, or if you wish, the number of D2 brains in the system. But that requires that you also know the size and of the system, and also if it's a perfect circle or if it's a different shape curve. So there is, however, a completely unambiguous way of computing from the supergravity solution, and this will be important for the black rings, of computing the number of D2 brains or of D brains in the system that don't carry a net charge, but that generate multiple moments. The way you do that is simply by performing the same integral over a different sphere. So if this is the cross-section of the D2 brain, let's suppose it's an S1, the way you compute the number of D2 brains is you take a sphere, something that's topologically a sphere, that links the cross-section of the tube. So in this case, this would be an S6, OK? If you compute that for an S6 at infinity, you get 0. But if you compute it for one that precisely links the cross-section once, then what you get is precisely the number of D2 brains. The idea behind this is that if instead of a contractible circle, this was just an infinitely extended string, the way you would compute the charge would be precisely by going to the space transverse to the string and computing this integral over an S6 that goes around the string. Okay, so in this case, all that's happening is that this string is closing over itself. But the same integral still measures unambiguously the dipole, or the number of D2 brains. So as I said, the existence of systems in which there is a local number of D2 brains, or high-dimensional D brains, that don't generate net conserved charges is what leads to non-uniqueness. Because to specify the solution, you need to specify those dipoles. But those dipoles are not conserved charges. Any questions? OK. I just want to make a few more comments about this system to make contact with things that Samir was saying. And then we'll move on to black rings. Yes. In principle, what you know is that if you have conserved charges, then which you measure at infinity, whatever happens dynamically in your spacetime, those charges will not change. Here, you could imagine exciting this system so that you break supersymmetry, then the system will radiate and will contract. It will radiate its angular momentum, for example, in the form of gravitons or emitting D0 brains, et cetera. And then the D2 brain will disappear. So the number of D2 brains in the system will not be conserved. Good. There are higher dipoles here. In fact, if you take a completely arbitrary shape, you can expand it in Fourier modes, the shape of the cross-section. And then it turns out you can write down exactly what the supergravity solution is for any shape. And you will recover those modes in the Fourier expansion from the falloff of the fields at infinity. So the way you write down these solutions is exactly as Samir explained. You use this superposition principle because these are BPS systems. it turns out that you can even superpose different tubes at different places, et cetera. And everything boils down to writing down harmonic functions. This is true. This is a very important fact. This is true for supertubes that carry two net charges. Once you go up to three charges, which is what we will have to do to have finite area horizons, that's no longer true, at least naively. The system doesn't naively linearize, even if you impose supersymmetry. So let me make a comment about bound states. It turns out, and this is an exercise that's suggested in the notes, that if you take a supertube with a circular cross section for simplicity, then you can prove that the angular momentum is given by the number of D2 branches times the radius squared, and that this is smaller or equal than the total F1 charge times the total D0 charge divided by Q D2, by the number of D2 branches. And the reason why there is this, why this is an upper bound, and it's not always saturated for a supersymmetric solution with these charges, is that precisely because of the BPS property, I can place a fundamental string or a D0 brain at any distance from the supertube, and there will be no force between them, because the supertube preserves the same supersymmetries as the fundamental strings or the D0 brains. In particular, I can place them on top of the supertube without binding them. But if I don't bind them, then they will not contribute to these electric and magnetic fluxes. They will just be superposed. Therefore, they will not generate a momentum. And for that reason, I will have more charge. I will have extra charge in the system that looks exactly as if it was bound to the tube, but because it's not bound, it's not contributing to increasing the angular momentum. So in general, for a system with these charges, there is only an upper bound on J that's given by this expression here. So if you want a true bound state, and this is something you can recover in supergravity, if you want a true bound state, you have to look at solutions that saturate this bound. And I think the dual statement would be in Samir's picture that you want strings. You want just one long string and not multiple strings. OK, any questions? Good. So let's talk about black rings. So the picture I just erased can be summarized by the following array. We had fundamental strings along a given direction. Let's call it 1. We also had D0 brains, which are point-like. And we had a D2 brain in the 1 and psi direction. So psi here is the angle along the cross section. And now the idea is that, sorry, I should have said the supergravity solution for the two charge supertube is singular. If you want to generate solutions, objects that have these cross sections that are supported by angular momentum, that have finite area horizons, you may well guess that you will need at least 3 charges. This system only has 2 charges. And as Samir explained this morning, the system with 2 charges doesn't have a classical entropy. The area, classically, in supergravity is 0, unless you include higher order R squared corrections. But just in supergravity, it's 0. If you want to generate a solution or a system with finite area, you have to have at least 3 net charges. Okay? So the idea is now to go from the 2 charge to the 3 charge supertube. And that will be an object that will have a finite area horizon around the cross section. And it turns out that the easiest way to construct those solutions is to go to an appropriate frame, namely to M theory. So to lift everything to 11 dimensions. And the way to do it is as follows. If you take this configuration and you t-dualize twice in the directions orthogonal to all the objects here, let's say in the 2 and 3 directions, the f1s stay the same. The d0s become d2s in the 2, 3 directions. And the d2 becomes a d4, sorry, in the 1, 2, 3 psi directions. And now you can lift this to 11 dimensions. There, both the fundamental string and the d2 brains become membranes. So let's write it as, what I wanted to do, just to make it look nicer, is to do it in the 3 and 4 directions. 4, 4, and psi. So the fundamental string is a membrane, say in the 1, 2 directions. The d2 comes also from a membrane that's not wrapped on the 11th dimension, so it's on the 3, 4 directions. And the d4 is a 5 brain in the 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4 psi direction. So this is another dual version of the supertube in which you start with 2 membranes. And when you add angular momentum, they expand to a 5 brain, which I'm representing with little m here because it doesn't carry a net charge, only dipoles. And now the idea to have a system with 3 charges is, let me erase this from here for a second, is to add a 3rd membrane, which is orthogonal to the previous ones in the 5, 6 directions. And then when you add angular momentum, each of these membranes, they will pairwise expand into a 5 brain. So the first 2 will give me the one I had in the 1, 2, 3, 4 psi. The 1st and the 3rd will give me something in the 1, 2, 5, 6 psi. And the last 2 will give another 5 brain in the 3, 4, 5, 6 psi direction. So this is a 3-charge supertube that also has not 1, but 3 dipoles. So this system will be characterized by the number of membranes in these directions, Q1, Q2, and Q3, and also by 3 different dipoles, Q1, Q2, and Q3. So we will take these directions here, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 directions, to be compact. So they will be 6 torus. And then because we are in 11 dimensions, we have the transverse directions, the space-like transverse directions are 4. And of course, if you remember that you also have time, effectively, this is a system in 1 plus 4, namely 5 dimensions. And of course, the black ring will be the solution you obtain when you take this system and compactify it on the 6 torus and look only at the solution in the 5 non-compact directions. So in those directions, let me draw a picture. So there will be a two-plane in which the cross-section, which I will henceforth take to be a circle all the time. So there will be an S1 here in some two-plane in R4. There will also be an orthogonal R2. And I will call the polar angle in the plane of the S1 psi. And the one in the orthogonal plane, I will call it phi. The reason why, in the three charge case, I'm going to restrict myself from the very beginning to cross sections that are a perfect circle, as opposed to some wiggly curve, is because it turns out that when you look at the supergravity solutions, the only ones that have a completely regular event horizon will be the ones for which the cross section is a perfect S1. You can construct solutions that carry three charges and three dipoles and have a cross section that's not a perfect S1, but those ones don't have a regular horizon in the strict sense of general relativity. Any questions about this? OK, so I could now go on and write down the metric, but it's sort of messy, so I won't do it. You can find it in the references. What I will do is to describe for you where the main physical properties that you can derive from the corresponding supergravity solution that I'm not going to write down. Let me just mention or emphasize again what I said before, which is that the reason it took quite some time to find supersymmetric black rings, let alone, actually, this is a strange case because the non-supersymmetric solution was found first. But even for the supersymmetric ones, it turns out that after you impose supersymmetry, the equations that you have to solve are still nonlinear. So supersymmetry typically reduces all the equations of motion to a few of them, and those ones happen to be linear. In this case, that's not true. So to find the solution, at least originally, what happened is that we had to solve nonlinear equations. It turns out you can rewrite them in a way, in a clever way, in which you end up solving linear equations. But you have to think much harder about how to do that. So anyway, what are the physical properties of these solutions? Well, remember I told you that in this system we had two net charges, and that was the reason why it preserved one quarter of the supersymmetries, because each of the charges breaks supersymmetry by a half. So in this case, because we have three independent net charges, only 1/8 SUSY is preserved. The solution is, of course, stationary and asymptotically flat. It's stationary and not static because there is angular momentum. So the 5D solution is stationary and asymptotically flat. And now let's count how many parameters the solution is characterized by. And that will tell us already that uniqueness is violated. So let's call R the radius of the S1. Then how many parameters does the solution depend on? Well, we have to specify three net charges, three dipoles, and the radius. So we have seven parameters. Qi, little qi, and r, where I goes from 1 to 3. And you may think that the mass Sorry, these are the parameters you have to specify. Now, how many conserved charges does this system carry? Well, let's count them. We have, of course, the big Qs are conserved charges. So the Qis. And then we have the angular momenta. So let me write them down for future reference. There is angular momentum in the plane of the ring, j psi, and angular momentum in the plane orthogonal to the ring. And one of the things we will see is that the presence of the second angular momentum is one of the puzzles that you have to resolve in order to count the entropy. Let me remind you, or emphasize, I should have emphasized it earlier. But in the two-charge case, if you take the cross-section of the tube to lie in a given two-plane, then, as you would expect, there is only angular momentum in that two-plane, okay? Because the angular momentum supposedly comes from the linear momentum that's tangent to the cross-section. It turns out that in the supersymmetric three-charge case, there is also angular momentum in the plane orthogonal to the ring. And this is one of the most puzzling aspects, as I will emphasize probably more tomorrow. But for the moment, let me write it down. So this one is given by 1/2 of little q1, big q1, plus q2, q2, plus q3, q3, minus q1, q2, q3. And this other one is given by 1/2, r squared q1 plus q2 plus q3 plus j phi. The first thing you notice is that this first term, r squared q, is precisely the generalization to three dipoles of the angular momentum I wrote down in the two-charge case. Remember here, the angular momentum was in the plane of the ring was r squared q d2. So now we have three dipoles. So the first term, if you like, is a supertube-like term. But this second term here, this second contribution, which is exactly equal to the angular momentum in the orthogonal plane, is very mysterious. And as I will try to argue, there is no trace of it in the microscopic description. So it will turn out that we will be able to count the entropy of the black ring by counting microscopic states that have zero j phi, as opposed to the black ring that has a non-zero j phi. But anyway, we'll get to that probably tomorrow. What I'd like to emphasize here is that we have five conserved charges. We have three gauge charges and two angular momenta. These are all conserved. Of course, we also have a mass that's a conserved charge. But because these are supersymmetric solutions, the mass saturates a BPS bound. So it's given by the sum of the net charges. And therefore, it's not an independent parameter or an independent conserved charge. So we have five conserved charges. But to specify the solution, I need seven parameters. That means that these solutions violate uniqueness by two continuous parameters. Or in other words, if you fix the total conserved charges, the big Qs and j phi and j psi, you can still vary independently two of the little q's, and that will not change the conserved charges. But of course, the solution when you change the little q's is different. And not only the solution is different, but the entropy changes. So if you want to reproduce the entropy of these objects, microscopically, you have to take into account how the q's, the little q's, enter the microscopic description. I should emphasize that this violation of this infinite violation of uniqueness is a classical violation, meaning that classically the little q's or the big q's are not quantized, and that's why you violate uniqueness by an infinite amount. Quantum mechanically, of course, only solutions that carry correctly quantized dipoles and charges will correspond to something in the quantum theory. And it turns out that there is a restriction on the big q's, on the little q's of this form. If you demand that the supergravity solutions are free of pathologies, meaning they have no closed time like curves, for example, then you can show that the big q's and the little q's have to satisfy constraints of this form. Q1, Q3, and Q3 greater or equal than Q1, Q2. Okay, so if you demand that this be satisfied and the little q's and the big q's are quantized, then there's only a finite violation of uniqueness. Because once you fix the total conserved charges, in particular you fix the big q's, there is only a finite number of integers, in fact, natural numbers, because you can, by convention, take all the charges to be positive. There is only a finite number of values for the little q's that will satisfy this constraint. If they are too big, you will violate it, and there is only a finite number of them because they are discrete. Sorry? Yes, all the big Q's and the little Q's are all quantized because they all measure the number of membranes or the number of fibrins in the system. So even though these little Q's are not conserved, they are quantized. Sorry? If you set the little q's to zero, you just get a superposition of orthogonal membranes. In that case, you can write down, okay, so if the, let's see, you can see it from here. So if the little q's are zero, there is no angular momentum, and all you get is just a superposition. Let's ask the question, in this case, which is simpler to draw. Okay? So if you set the number of D2 brains to zero, you just get a superposition on a circle, a distribution of fundamental strings and D0 brains, which you can have because they are BPS objects. So you can place them wherever you like. Sorry? Sorry, I didn't get that. Oh, good, okay. In the supersymmetric case, if you said, unless you have all the three q's different from zero, the horizon doesn't have finite area. So if you want a finite area, a regular horizon, you need all the q's to be non-zero in the supersymmetric case. In the non-extremal case, you can have solutions that have, for example, only two dipoles and still have a finite area horizon because it's non-extremal, but not in the supersymmetric case. And in fact, one of the open problems is finding the most general non-extremal or near extremal, I should say, solution that reduces to this one in the extremal limit. So there are non-extremal solutions that are known with up to two dipoles, three charges and two dipoles, but not three dipoles. OK. Any more questions? Higher multiple moments. Yeah. So the point is that if you impose that the cross section is a circle, then of course all the multiple moments are non-zero, but they are all determined in terms of a single quantity, which is the radius. So once you specify the radius, they are all fixed, and the number of the little q's. As I said, you can construct solutions with three charges and three dipoles and independent multiple moments, which correspond to wiggly cross sections. But those ones are very interesting, but they don't have a regular horizon. Yes. What did I do?
Suppose I use progressive dot density that the small q comes from the number of the integrands. How do you get to the conclusion that q is quantized? You can't really use the accessory argument to get the conclusion that it's integer.
Right. So you have to tell me, if you give me the solution, I can look at it and see if there is a horizon. If there is a horizon that has topology S1 cross S2, then I can construct, as long as I don't destroy the horizon, I can construct a non-contractible S2 that links the horizon. And the flux through that S2 has to be quantized. So if that flux corresponds with the parameter q, little q, that you have in the solution, then that little q has to be quantized. But of course, in general, if somebody gives you a supergravity solution, I think there is no reason why the higher than monopole moments should be quantized. It has to do with the existence of non-contractible cycles in your spacetime. OK, so yes. What entropy? The Bekenstein-Hawking entropy? Let's see. So I think the answer to that is that if you take the black ring, the supersymmetric black ring solution, which is a specific solution, and you set one of the little q's to zero, then the area of the horizon goes to zero. Now, it's true you can write down another solution that has membrane charges that will have finite area. That's, I think, what you're saying, which will have an S3 horizon. No, it's not a smooth limit, no. No. I'll probably say something more about that tomorrow. So please remind me if I don't answer more completely your question. So in fact, what I'm going to do right now is to write down the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy in terms of these quantities. And you'll see that it vanishes if you set one of the little q's to zero. So let me write it down. Okay. So if you compute the area of the horizon, you get the following expression. And you divide by 4 times Newton's constant, you get 2 pi square root of d squared over 4, where d is q1, q2, q3, minus d times j psi, minus 1/4 of q1 squared, q1 squared, plus q2 squared, q2 squared, plus q3 squared, q3 squared, plus d over 2, q1, q2 over q3, plus permutations, so q2, q3 over q1, plus q1, q3 over q2. Where d, yeah, it's the product of the three dipoles. So you see that if you set one of the q's to 0, then d, well, here, because there's q1, q2, q3, there are actually no little q's in the denominators. So this term vanishes. This one vanishes as well, obviously. And these ones vanish too. Sorry? Which one doesn't vanish? This? This? Oh, sorry. Sorry, yeah. Sorry. It's a bit more complicated than this because, okay. This expression that I wrote down here is not manifestly inside the square root positive. Okay? So in fact, if you look at the supergravity solution, the equivalent of the bound that I gave you in the two charge case, remember I said that J was smaller or equal than QF1, QD0 over QD2. Remember this bound? There's a corresponding bound in the three charge case. That is, it's more complicated, but comes from requiring precisely that the area be greater or equal than 0, which is precisely the statement that this expression has to be positive. If that expression is not positive, the solution doesn't have, in the limit in which the expression goes to 0, the area goes to 0. And beyond that, the solution is not well behaved. Okay, so one of the things that I'd like to do tomorrow is, well, first of all, let me mention one thing. And that is that when I wrote down that expression, I chose to write it down in terms of 7 independent parameters. Remember I told you that the solution depends on 7 parameters, which of course you can choose freely to be whichever ones you like, as long as they are independent. The ones I chose here are the big QIs, the little QIs, and J psi. So instead of choosing the radius, I chose J psi. I could have chosen some other combinations, but you'll see this is a form that is more appropriate to compare with a microscopic calculation. And one of the goals tomorrow is to see how you reproduce this entropy with a microscopic calculation. And one of the reasons why I wrote it down in terms of J psi and not J phi is because we will reproduce this formula by counting microscopic states that have 0 J phi. Now, if the entropy had depended, let me rephrase it. Had I not been able to write the entropy in terms of parameters that do not include J5, then I would have already reached a contradiction with what I said here. Okay, because if the entropy depends, if there is no way to eliminate J5, then there's no way I will be able to reproduce that expression by counting states with zero J5. So there's no immediate contradiction, and hopefully tomorrow I'll be able to convince you that that's the correct thing to do. Sorry, I didn't hear that. Oh, multi-ring configurations. Okay, good. Yeah, so the question is, if you can find supergravity solutions that correspond to superpositions, multi-ring superpositions. So the answer is yes. And there is more than one way of doing it. The most general way is to use a method, well, an observation, a very clever observation by Ben and Warner. They, what they did was to take the supergravity, 11-dimensional supergravity, look at the constraints imposed by 1/8 supersymmetry associated to the projectors of these three charges. That gives you some set of BPS equations, which reduce the equations of motion to a subset. And then within, if you try to solve that by brute force without thinking too much about it, you end up trying to solve nonlinear equations. But the point is that if you rewrite that set of equations in the right form, then you end up solving equations that are always linear. The reason being that you have some set of fields, say, AI, BI, CI. And then when you solve for these ones, you solve some linear equations. And then once you have found the AIs, they enter as sources for the BIs. So you have some other differential operator on the Bs. And the As enter quadratically. So it's a nonlinear equation. But if you've solved first for AI, then this is just a source for the Bs. And then you can solve that. And finally, the same for the Cs. This depends on the As and the Bs. So solving it in that way, you end up solving linear equations. Although, it's not true that the final solution is just a naive superposition of solutions, because once you have solved for part of the fields, they enter non-linearly in the equations for the other ones. Every? I believe so. Yes, I believe so, yes. Even though for the most general superposition of rings, of a pair of rings, say, nobody has explicitly verified that. But there is another way of constructing solutions. If you want to construct concentric ring solutions, which may be rotated with respect to each other, but which have a common center, then you can use the fact that you can write the metric for these solutions in what's called the Gibbons-Hawking form. And in that way, you also end up solving linear equations. And actually, solving the equations in the Gibbons-Hawking form is what allows you to replace, I'll mention this tomorrow if I have time, replace asymptotically flat solutions by asymptotically taubnat solutions, which you can then use to reduce down to four dimensions. And that's how the connection with 4D black holes is made. Any more questions? In the middle of the ring? Here? It, It's a black hole. So everywhere outside the horizon, the spacetime is completely smooth. The horizon is a regular horizon, so you can extend the metric through the horizon. And if you ask me what is the singularity structure behind the horizon, I don't know. I haven't studied that. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Is there a Euclidean? A Euclidean section? That's a very good question. I believe there isn't. I played a little bit with it, and not too hard, but if you try to rotate, analytically continue everything you can continue, and allow all the parameters to become complex and so on, or imaginary, I couldn't come up with, playing with it for a little while, I couldn't come up with something that gave you a completely real Euclidean section. And you could ask the same question for the non-supersymmetric one, for the pure vacuum solution that Roberto Imparan and Harvey Real found. And I haven't really looked at it, but from what they tell me, there isn't one either. These ones don't hook in radiate because they are extremal. Yeah, you could. I haven't personally studied that, but you could study that in that case, yeah. Ah, good, okay. So, because here you don't have spherical symmetry, you only have U1 cross U1 symmetry, it turns out that almost all calculations you can do with spherical black holes turn out to be very difficult here. The equations don't separate, et cetera. And that's, for example, one of the reasons why studying the stability directly of, say, the non-supersymmetric one turns out to be, nobody has actually done that. And I know some of my collaborators have tried very hard. But it's this lack of symmetry that makes the fluctuation analysis very difficult. So I think this is probably a good point to start, unless there are more questions.
The situation where you have small cubes and you don't rotate it enough, then you produce closed time-like curves. That's the point.
No, if you over-rotate it.
If you over-rotate.